أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. We are on page 61, the tenets of faith. Of course, we will very quickly deal with this chapter because then we want to go to that chapter on the self-knowledge and see how much of it we can cover, inshallah. Now, the tenets of faith, what he basically wants to say here is that where should we get our belief? And it's a very, very important issue. Of course, we have to get our belief from the Quran. And we have to understand the Quran with our intellects. In that section on knowledge, we discussed about this in details. Without using intellect, we cannot understand anything from faith, from religion, whether it's Quran or the Hadith of A'imma alayhimus salam. And therefore, he says that there are two main sources from which we get our tenets of faith. One is the revelation, and revelation includes the Quran and its interpretation by those who are inspired with the knowledge of the Quran. That's the Prophet and A'imma alayhimus salam. And then he mentions very emphatically that the Quran and A'imma cannot be separated from each other because the A'imma are invested with the inspired knowledge of the Quran, something which no one else have. And therefore, we cannot say that, okay, we take the Quran and leave the A'imma alayhimus salam and we understand the Quran ourselves. Of course, everyone has some understanding of the Quran, but the pure and unmistakable understanding of the Quran is with A'imma alayhimus salam. And therefore, he deals in length about the traditions which says that the Prophet said, "Inni tarakun fikum al-thaqalain kitab Allahi wa itrati," and they do not part from each other. The book and the itra do not part from each other until the day of judgment, meaning that the Quran is actually description of what these A'imma are doing, and what they do is an explanation of the Quran, and therefore you cannot separate them from each other. If you want the correct understanding of the Quran, you have to refer to the to A'imma alayhimus salam. So by revelation, what we mean by revelation is the Quran and whatever is related to the Quran. That is the sunnah of the Prophet, the interpretation of A'imma alayhimus salam, and all these things. And then he says there is another source for our knowledge, and that is fitra. That is what is inherent in us. And that is what he calls, of course, the intellect. Now, he says at the beginning, know that it is not permissible to adopt tenets of faith other than what Allah has revealed to the prophets and their vicegerents alongside the intrinsic knowledge. This intrinsic knowledge is very important, and this is what we call the fitra. Now, in the paragraph at the bottom of page 61, he describes the fitra. He defines what fitra, what do we mean by fitra of human being. The fitra is the inherent human nature, the instinctive intellect. This instinctive intellect is something that if human beings are left to themselves, they realize, for example, God is one. Instinctive intellect of every human being accepts it. Then, of course, theology comes in. Okay, how do we describe him? Whether he is physical or metaphysical, or do we have demigods beside him as well? Then these things come in and people are confused. But when you ask, even if you ask the mushrikun, the idolaters, those who worship idols, at the end of the day, they say that, yes, there is someone who has created all this. God is one. This is the instinctive, this intellect is the fitra. And this is what the mushrikun of Mecca believed as well. That, وَلَا إِن سَأَلْتَهُمْ مَنْ خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ لَا يَقُولُنَّ اللَّهِ. If you ask them who has created the heavens and the earth, and who has created these idols, and who has created these demigods, they say Allah. However, of course, then the theology was convoluted, deviated from the right path. Even the Hindus who worship idols now, they believe in one God who has created everything. And this does not make them monotheists, of course. The instinctive intellect says this. However, when we want to put that in practice or when we want to explain it further, then we deviate. We explain it in probably in a polytheistic way. Anyhow, the fetra is the inherent human nature, the instinctive intellect which acts as an inner moral compass. Very good expression. It's moral compass. It tells you. That fetra tells you that lying is wrong. Who has taught us lying is wrong? Of course, even if our parents do not tell us lying is wrong, when we are very little children, we know ourselves lying is wrong. We know injustice is wrong. This is inherent. This is the moral compass that Allah has placed in every human being. We call it conscience or whatever. However, it is in our fitra. Now, the intellect, here he explains very beautifully the relationship between the intellect and the revelation. Because some people say that we don't need the intellect. We have the revelation, we have the Quran, we have the Hadith. We just go to that and we close our minds to everything else. Or some say we have our intellect, we have our understanding, we are rational people. Why do we need revelation? He says these two are in a sort of symbiotic relationship with each other. They need each other. Revelation needs the intellect and intellect needs the revelation. The intellect is like a lamp and the divine law is revelation, of course, it's not just fiqh, is like oil for the lamp. The oil without the lamp cannot glow. The lamp without the oil cannot give light. So they need each other. And actually, the verse Ayatul Nur that we have, that Allah Nur as-samawati wal-ard mathalu nurihi fi mishkatin fiha misbah, that misbah is the revelation, the light of Allah. Al-misbah fi zujaja, that zujaja, that glass in which the misbah is placed, is the heart or intellect of human being. And when that intellect and revelation come together, then yakadu zaytuha yuzi walau lam tamsashu nar, it wants to glow and give guidance and give light. So he gives another example as well. Without the oil, the lamp will not light. Without the lamp, the oil will not glow by itself. And the other example at the top of page 62, similarly, the intellect is like the eyes, and the divine law is like the rays of the sun. Now, to see, you need both. You cannot say, because we have the rays of the sun, because sun is shining, so I can see everything. No, you need your eyes. And you cannot say, because I have eyes, I can see without the rays of the sun. It's not possible. So these two are always going hand in hand. One may say, I have seen many people, very Puritan people. They say, we want to completely follow the revelation. We don't want to somehow mix it with anything from our own understanding, intellect, or whatever. It is impossible. It's not possible at all. Allah has put these two together. He has relied on our intellect and our understanding. Actually, He has created it. And this is His blessing. And therefore, these two should go together. And that's why in the Quran, you see that there are lots of rational arguments there, invoking our intellectual understanding. Ask them about certain things. أَمْ خُلِقُوا مِنْ غَيْرِ شَيْءٍ أَمْ هُمُ الْخَالِقُونَ, are they created out of nothing, or have they created themselves? You see, these rational arguments are all tapping on our intellectual understanding, because that is another light that Allah has put. He mentioned in the previous chapters that the intellect is like the internal prophet. We mentioned this. And the revelation is like the external intellect. So we have an external aql That is revelation, and an internal wahi, and that is the aql and intellect. Okay, if someone follows the intellect, and intellect works in a perfect manner, always intellect and revelation are in conformity. They cannot contradict with each other. And that's why we have this maxim, كُلُّ مَا حَكَمَ بِهِ الشَّرْ حَكَمَ بِهِ الْعَقْلِ. Whatever is the edict of شَرْ is the edict of intellect as well. And vice versa, whatever is the edict of your intellect, it's the edict of your or the revelation as well. However, we see in many times these two come to clash against each other. Isn't it? What we understand clashes against what is written in the book. And we say, this cannot be. For example, this may be in factual statements of the book about the, how the world is created, for example, and about the prescriptions, about the values. Sometimes our intellect does not accept certain values from the book, and we say, this cannot be. This doesn't go according to what we understand in terms of our own conscience and our values. Now, he says that by value, by intellect, I don't mean the intellect which is beset by base desires. Usually our intellect is beset by base desires. Our desires create values for us, and then we think that these are values based on rational understanding, based on reason, based on intellect, and then it comes into clash against the revelation. If the intellect is not mixed with base desires, then it goes completely in conformity with Sharia. And that's why, no matter a revelation comes to the Prophet or doesn't come to the Prophet, we know that whatever Prophet did was not revelation. Not everything that Prophet did was revelation. Of course, many things he did was based on revelation, or many things he said was revelation. However, many things he said or he did was not based on revelation. However, we are told to follow it. Why? If it was not based on revelation, why are we told to follow it? Why should we follow the sunnah of the Prophet alongside the revelation? Because the Prophet had perfect intellect. And perfect intellect works like revelation. The same thing. There's no difference. So a person who has perfect intellect, whatever they do is actually based on the guidance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Okay, he then says, do not take Quran lightly, because Quran is very deep and is help in every time, in all times, in every situation. Sometimes we think that whatever the Quran is saying is not related to our time at all. It talks about Ad and Thamud. We don't know when these people lived at all, or where they lived, for example. Several thousand years ago, talks about their values, their misjudgments, or their judgments, or whatever. How does it connect to our world? And how are we going to make use of all these? Some of the things mentioned in the Quran does not actually match very well with the situation we are living now. Now, he says, do not take Quran lightly. Do not just look at the surface of the Quran. Quran, its surface is beautiful, but its depth is unfathomable. And the only thing is that you have to really read it to understand it in a submissive manner. If you submit yourself to the Quran, then it guides you. If you do not submit yourself to the Quran and always want to bring your own values in and saying that, well, this point I don't accept, this point is wrong, this point, then of course Quran cannot guide you. Well, some of us do not read the Quran at all, then we are at peace. There is no problem. There's no problem there. There is no contradiction. But for those of us who really want to get guidance from the Quran, the main issue is you have to submit completely. Then it will guide you. Then it will tell you what are its values. He mentions one hadith from Amir al-Mu'min alayhi salam, page 64, Al-Qur'an zahiruhu aniqa wa batinuhu amiq. Outwardly, the Qur'an is systematic, and inwardly, it's deep. Aniq means, of course, has systematic beauty. Its wonders never cease, its marvels never end, and darkness can only be lifted through it. Now, what Amir al-Mu'min here says is very, somehow very strange. لا ينكشف الظلمات إلا به. The darkness cannot be lifted except by the Quran. And that means when we are absolutely confused in our time, the only thing that we can refer to is the Quran. However, referring to the Quran has its own manners, has its, you have just like a teacher that you want to get things from it, you have to sit before the Quran long times every day and see what the Quran has to teach you. That is the most important thing. And of course, it cannot be fully grasped by translation. You have to learn Arabic as well. And therefore, if we really want the darkness to go away, this is a teacher which is somehow hard to convince to teach you, because it has lots of prerequisites, lots of preconditions for you to sit in this class. But after you sit in the class and you totally submit, then of course the darkness would go away. Gradually you realize what are the divine values and what are the base values. Because usually this is the most thing which confuses us, the divine values and the base values. And the Quran can remove this confusion. Of course, as I said, it is a teacher which you cannot get into the class of this teacher easily. It needs some purification, it needs attention, it needs time, it needs learning, and all these things, then the Quran can teach you. Anyhow, then he goes about Thaqalain, which you read yourself. A tradition on page 66, again, about the Quran. The two lines at the end of page 66, it has both an exterior as well as hidden interior. Its outer is law, and its inner is knowledge. Of course, what you see, the surface of the Quran talks about laws of Sharia. But if you think deeper, then it is knowledge that you can gain. Its outer is systematically beautiful and its inner is deep. It has underlying depths within which are yet farther depths. Its wonders cannot be enumerated, nor its marvels fathomed. This was from Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam. Now, he says that if you do not get your faith from the Quran and from Ahlul Bayt, and you just learn it from people, he says that, he says this, then people who have brought you the faith, other people can take away this faith from you. Unless your faith is rooted in your inner intellect and in deep contemplation and in the Quran, then it could be shaken very easily. He mentions a hadith from one of the A'imma alayhi salam, doesn't mention, from the Prophet, peace be on him. Sorry, from one of the A'imma, it doesn't mention which Imam, on page 68, من أخذ دينه من كتاب الله وسنة نبيه صلى الله عليه وسلم زالت الجبال قبل أن يزول ومن أخذ دينه من أفواه الرجال ردته الرجال. Whenever someone takes his religion from the Book of Allah and the Sunnah of his Prophet, his faith will outlive the mountains. Whenever someone takes his religion from the mouth of people, these same people will refute him or will take away from the, well, refute him, maybe not a good word here for translation, will take away the faith from him the other day. Yes.
And what is it you mean by people? And how are we supposed to do that? How do you distinguish?
People who just talk based on their own opinion rather than based on the book of the based on Kitab and Sunnah of the Prophet.
Okay, that's fine. Even you can get scholars in inverted commas who could, potentially be not understanding the Quran.
Scholars can bring you faith and can take away faith from you, isn't it?
Yes. how are you to know what a true scholar is and how you know, it's like a cat and mouse situation. I mean, what comes first, chicken or egg? And how do you know whether that person is giving you what he's giving you when you are not even capable of understanding? Is there something within your fitra that will...
That is why. He is talking about those people who are seeking knowledge themselves. So if you seek knowledge, seek it from the source. Do not seek it from others. But for ordinary people, of course, they have to rely on those who have sought this knowledge. And then... yes, their faith can move from here to there. That's the way the world works, isn't it? But if you see someone is, for example, we have some scholars who only talk based on hadith. They never refer to the Quran. Okay? We have to doubt why these scholars never refer to the Quran, for example. What's wrong there? Either they don't have knowledge of the Quran, that means their knowledge is incomplete. Or they have knowledge of the Quran, but they don't get their knowledge from the Quran. They get it from another source, for example. Or there are some people who always talk about my opinion. Rationally, it doesn't, for example, seem right. Or these things. When you see people are not basing their arguments initially based on the Quran, and then on, of course, the Hadith, which is the counterpart of the Quran, then we have to doubt whether we can follow them or we cannot follow them. That's the main thing.
So, just to conclude, you're saying that any kind of intellectual or seeking of knowledge has to be accompanied by the Quran as a source and a basis?
Knowledge of religion. Knowledge of, not any type of knowledge, of course.
Yeah,
knowledge of religion, yeah.
The basis has to be the Quran.
Yes, yes.
Absolutely, without a doubt.
Oh, of course.
If there is any book or lecture or whatever that may be that does not allude to this, then one has to question that.
Yes, of course. Yeah. And if we say things or bring a hadith which are somehow not conforming with the Quran, okay, then of course we have to reject it. It's very clear.
It says there is an infallible mountain, so what is this? Which mountain is talking about?
Which hadith, sorry?
This hadith, the one you did.
Yeah, he doesn't mention which hadith. It's related that the infallible imam has said, so he doesn't mention which imam. He doesn't mention it. Maybe in the references, number 15, because they have made, from Kafi, and Kafi sometimes does not mention which imam he reports from, so it's not clear which imam. Okay. Now, page 70, teaching the tenets of faith to the youth. This, I would like you to read it very carefully, this section. Of course, some of the things which he says may not be possible to practice in our time. For example, he says, do not expose the youth to views and ideas that they cannot analyze. Philosophical views and views which goes against the Sharia. Nowadays, of course, the youth has access to everything by the internet and in school. So he's talking about his own time. We have to certainly make this analysis sit in our time. However, generally what he says is right. First of all, you should not think that the youth, your children, are all the same or can take the same dose of faith and religion. They are very different. He mentions a hadith here on page 71. لَوْ عَلَمَ النَّاسِ كَيْفَ خَلَقَ اللَّهِ هَذَا الْخَلْقِ لَمْ يَلُمْ أَحَدٌ أَحَدًا. If people knew how Allah brought creation into being, the creation of human beings, they would never disparage each other. Because we do not understand our differences. We want everyone to be the same. He says, everyone is not the same. And this acts for your children as well. Your children are not the same. Some of them may be more prone to faith and worship. Some of them may be less prone to faith and worship. And therefore we have to be very careful not to break them, not to force things upon them which would somehow repel them from everything. And also, people have different degrees in faith. He mentions one hadith here. إِنَّ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ عَلَى مَنَازِلْ. Again, on top of page 79. مِنْهُمْ عَلَى وَاحِدَ. And the translation, bottom of page 70. Believers are at different stages of belief. Some are at the first or second, others at the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, or seventh level of faith. If you impose the second stage of belief on someone who only has the first, he will not be able to bear it. Nor can you impose the third stage of belief on someone who only has the second. You will break them. If you want to do this, you would break them. Sometimes we try to impose more than what our children can take. And that would, in a way, make them escaping from whatever is related to faith and other things. And also, al-iman halatun wa darajat wa tabaqatun wa manazil. This is very beautiful. It's not only levels, it's aspects, different fields, different areas of faith that people have, different ways that they can understand God. And actually, why Allah creates so many people? We are not copies of each other, certainly, but every one of us understand God in a particular way. When I say in a particular way, not that the revelation then is not in place and we shouldn't follow it because everyone else understands God in a different way. No. Every one of us understand and take this revelation and understanding and knowledge in our own way. And that's why he said, At-turuhu ila Allah bi'adadi anfusil khala'iq. The ways to God is as many as the number of the people. This is the how we understand Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Some people have used this hadith, especially in recent age, to say that you don't need to follow one religion. You don't need to follow one faith. Because the ways to Allah are as various as the number of the people. Everyone can understand God in his own way. This is the wrong interpretation of this hadith. The right interpretation is that whatever knowledge is given to us in our intellect by prophets, each one of us understanding it in our own way. However, we all stick to that revelation. But what you understand from the book of God is different from what I understand from the book of God. What you understand from your relationship with God is different from what I understand. What experience you have in your salat is different from what experience I have in my salat. We all follow the same thing. However, people are different. That's why he says, faith has different states, degrees, stages, stations, halat, darajat, tabaqat, manazil. These are different aspects. فَمِنْهُ تَامُ الْمُنْتَهَ تَمَامُ. Some people have completed all the stages and others are obviously lacking in faith, while still others fluctuate from one extreme to the other extreme. They don't have perfect iman, and therefore we shouldn't somehow put a sort of blanket judgment on everyone that they all have to behave in the same way. They don't have to understand the faith in the same way. I have mentioned this before, I think, in other sessions, that you know, in paradise there's no vain talk. لا يسمعون فيها لغوان ولا تأثيما. They do not see, hear there any laghw, any vain talk, and they do not talk anything which would somehow attribute a sin to anyone. Now, if there's no vain talk, and certainly in paradise we don't have business, I guess. We don't need to attain anything, we don't have business. So you don't talk about business, you don't talk in vain, you don't backbite, there's no tathim. So what do they talk about? What do you think? What do they talk about? That the Quran always mentions they sit together and talk together. What do they talk about? So if all of them have reached that state of knowledge of Allah, so what knowledge they are talking to each other? It's true, because the experience of every individual in paradise from Allah is different from the experience of the other person. Therefore, they enjoy talking to each other. Actually, the highest enjoyment in paradise is to learn about each other's experience of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You see, so every individual has its place and has something to fulfill and be placed in this big jigsaw of creation. So this is very important. And this is what we have to understand. It is essential that a young person, the paragraph before last on page 71, be introduced to the tenets of the faith as soon as he is mature and able to distinguish right from wrong. First, he should memorize them. He can gradually uncover the meanings of these beliefs as he grows up. Begin with memorization, then understanding, then belief, and then conviction. So, we start from the very young age. However, it should be very gradual. We should not expect, of course, highly at the beginning when they are understand. And he says that at the beginning you don't need to furnish proofs for them. Because when you talk about God, they understand. It is in their nature. We think they don't understand when we talk about God, and we need to bring proof for them. We grown-ups need proof because our fetra is mixed and adulterated. Their fetra is pure. When you talk about God with them, they understand it. I have a little granddaughter. When at this age of six, she watched this film Mary, and she was crying. I was wondering, what does she understand that she's crying? And then once she told my daughter that she was watching this film Musa, the cartoon made by Hollywood somewhere. And she said, age of six, why is it that when they make a film about prophets, we don't care and it doesn't affect us at all, but when we make film about prophets, it's very good, we cry. It's very strange. They understand things that we do not really realize. It's in the fetra. Things go from heart to heart. That is the important thing. Things go, it's not all proof. It's not all beautiful explanation. You just say something, they get it from inside. And this is what he's trying to say. He says, do not somehow pollute the fetra of youngsters with lots of analysis and philosophy. And this is what is the Western education is trying to do, isn't it? The Western education brings lots of these things to children. And the children are confused, they lose their fetra. And at the end of the day, this is what we see. And when David Cameron talks about Christian society in England, everyone writes against him, no, we are atheist society, we are not a Christian society. Anyhow, read this chapter. This is a very beautiful chapter up to the end. And one other thing, look at page 78. He says that, page 77 and 78, he says that it is very important that when you talk about faith with your children, you don't talk nonsense. This is very important. And that means that you yourself should understand faith not in a nonsensical way. If you understand it in a nonsensical way, then you impart it to your children in a nonsensical way. And then they may not accept it. The fetra would not accept it. He gives several examples. One, on page 78, he says that we have to understand that religious literature, like any other literature, uses metaphors. And if we want to take everything literally, then we have actually distorted the whole meaning and idea. He says, look at this hadith. أَمَا يَخْشَى الَّذِي رَفَعَ رَأْسَهُ قَبْلَ الْإِمَامِ أَنْ يُحَوِّلَ اللَّهُ رَأْسَهُ رَأْسَ حِمَارٍ. Does the person who raises his head in Jama'ah prayer before the Imam not fear that Allah will turn his head into a donkey's head? Now, you want to say this to your children. Be careful. When you are doing Jama'ah, do not raise your head. Do not stand before the Imam. What happens, Daddy or Mommy, if I raise it? Well, you will be turned into a donkey. Well, he does it a couple of times. Or she does it a couple of times. Doesn't, well, nothing happened. I'm not a donkey. And so, well, that's nonsense. What is it? Now, he says, first of all, you have to understand the meaning of this hadith yourself. And that means, look at the explanation. He says, this has never happened literally and never will. It is meant to be a metaphor for the donkey's proverbial characteristic of stupidity. This is what is meant, not the literal meaning. It is a metaphor to say that it is foolish to follow the Imam while simultaneously you go ahead of him. You are like a donkey. So it doesn't make sense. You are stupid. You want to follow the Imam in Jama'ah, then you don't follow him. It's stupid. You are like a donkey. Now, then he says, of course, this is a very sort of exaggerated example, but when Allah wants to something to be, he says, be, and it is. And we take it literally. Yeah, Allah says, be, and it is. And you know, the theologians have discussed, sometimes one thinks about the stupidity of some of the theologians. They have discussed this. Okay, that be is a creation of God, isn't it? So for that be, he needs another be, isn't it? He should say be to that be, and that be is, and then that be would say be to the creation. And what about the other be? The be before it, he should say be. Well, they don't understand this is a metaphor of ease, the way Allah easily creates. And when he wants to create something, he just says be and it is. Just as simple as that. If we take it literally. And look at what he says at the bottom of page 78. Other similar examples are the metaphor of the Sirat, being a bridge stretched between heaven and hell, and the balance with two scales on either side. Now, what do we teach our children about the Sirat? Yeah, it's a bridge over the hell. You have to run over it. It's very sharp. It's very thin. Well, it's foolish, isn't it? And children would not believe it, of course. Well, they may believe it because of the faith. However, it's foolish to think that Sirat is like that. It's foolish to think Allah would do something like this to us. So we have to understand the metaphors that are in place to tell us about things which are not somehow grasped by the concepts that we have in this world. And also, of course, then he talks at the end about blind following, that we should not blindly follow anything that we hear. It's very important that we understand our tenets of faith and follow it thoughtfully. Any question up to here? Now we have to come to this chapter about Ma'rifatun Nafs. Any question? Yeah.
You said that whatever the prophet did pointed out of revelation, and it's a very sad question. But I just want to understand, don't you believe in the way the Quran knows more about religion?
Yeah, this is about the Quran. That Quran is wahyun yuha. Wama yantiqu anil hawa. He doesn't talk this Quran out of his hawa. It's only a revelation. Otherwise, for example, when he was talking to his wives, it was not a revelation, was it? Of course, Allah didn't tell him that you tell this to your wife now, for example, or what cook for me tonight. It's not a revelation. It's about the Quran, that Quran is a revelation revealed to him. It's not something that he has made up out of his hawa and his whims and wishes. Yeah, I know this verse is usually mentioned.
Yeah,
many, in many books also they mention that it means that whatever the Prophet did was based on what Allah revealed to him. This is impossible, rationally impossible. That's whatever he said or whatever he did was. But whatever he said and did was based on his intellect. And because his intellect was perfect, therefore we are told by Allah that we have to follow him. We have to follow him. Yes, yes.
You know what you said earlier, that children are very pure in their heart, that you give an example of a 6-year-old child. What age does a child grow up and start to be impure? 10, 12, 15?
I don't know. That's a very difficult question. It depends. Children vary. I mean, don't know. And impurity sometimes comes from outside, sometimes comes from inside. And, How they are brought up is partially important, not fully. I mean, I always give the example of Habil and Qabil. Isn't it? They were only one family, only one parent, Adam and Eve, and one was Qabil, the other one was Habil. So it's like that. Or look at these children of Ya'qub. What a sort of dishonest, mischievous children he had, and he was a prophet. Yes. I don't know. Yes.
Hadrat, before you start the next chapter, last time you mentioned you were going to talk about istikhara this time. I don't have that still in your plan.
About istikhara?
You mentioned you were going to speak about it.
Did I?
I think so.
Is it? Everyone approves of that? Because istikhara is not related at all.
Come on, how to seek advice from Allah, which is istikhara.
Ah. Anyhow, if you want, I can now talk about it, but it's not related to this topic. Maybe later, some other time, inshallah, we talk about it. Seeking advice from Allah.
Allah will advise us later.
Okay. All right. Yes.
One thing that you said was when we come to understand the Quran, you can't just go straight into it. There are prerequisites to it. Now, that to me concerns.
No, I don't say you cannot go directly to it. You can. However, you do not get that benefit which a learned person can take. A learned person with pure heart can take. Otherwise, everyone can directly go to the Quran, of course. It's for everyone. Yeah.
And they'll get different levels of guidance.
Yeah, different levels of guidance. And sometimes they are misguided by it, isn't it? The Quran says, we send down this Quran. Some are misguided by it, some are guided by it. So it depends on the person. It depends on the way they interact with the Quran.
So then following up from that, our scholars presumably are at different levels, and they're also going to the Quran and understanding different things from it, but also legislating based on that. Where can we can we have full confidence in that, or do we accept and reject based on our understanding?
Well, by scholars you mean the maraji, you mean those who actually infer laws from the Quran. Now, in the case of maraji, of course, because they go through the same system of education, mostly the products, the end product, which is a marja of this system of education, they have the same methods of inference. However, of course, some of them are sharper in their understanding, are quick-witted, and they can get things from Hadith and Quran which others may not be able to do. And that's why we talk about A'lam and non-A'lam. However, as I said, because we have the same system of education, then we have the same sort of system of inference from the Quran. But, I mean, having said that, it's important to realize that who is better well-versed in understanding, in inferring laws from the Quran and give it to us. Now, inference from the Quran of laws is different from that depth of, say, for example, theological understanding, social understanding. That's a completely different issue. Because law is a different matter than social and theological issues. We have to actually, for example, for tafsir, we know that we have to refer to Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli rather than to anyone else, because he is an expert in tafsir. Or Ayatollah Makarem Shirazi, who has written Namuna, is an expert. But it doesn't mean that other maraja are expert in tafsir as well. So we have to judge ourselves. The bad thing about us is that Allah hasn't left us with a sort of decisive decision that this is what you have to do. He all the time refers us to our intellect. And that is the difficult thing. We have to refer to our intellect. We have to decide for ourselves. And that is the hardship of the life, actually. And the beauty of the life. Okay, should we continue with the chapter on Ma'rifatun Nafs? What is nafs? What is nafs? Self. Okay? Now, page 83, by the self or nafs, we mean the subtle, immaterial essence that uses the physical body to fulfill its needs the way a master uses his servant. So first of all, it's subtle, you cannot define it really what nafs is, it's very difficult. And it's immaterial. And although it's immaterial, but it is in charge of the body, it's the king of the body. You see, I'm the king of my body. I'm not trying to convey something to you. My eyes are working, my mouth is working, my hands are working. You see, every organ, my soul is using all these to convey a meaning to you. So this body is the servant of that master of the king of the body, which is the soul. So by the soul, we mean that master which uses the body for its own purposes. Now, whatever purpose it is. And the feelings all are referred to that one soul, because the feelings may be stimulus from different nerves to individual cells, but individual cells cannot comprehend. There should be something which, again, uses these individual cells to get that feeling and then try to work to satisfy or to fend off or whatever those feelings would tell them. So this is the essence of man, his reality that knows higher truth. It has physical assistance in the form of limbs in the body and spiritual assistance in the form of the human faculties. The spiritual assistants are what is inspired to us from above. And the physical assistance, of course, is the body. These are the things which the soul has to manage itself in this world. And that's why when the soul leaves this body, they cannot actually have any effect in this world anymore, because the servant is gone. The servant, which is the body, is gone. They cannot have any influence in this world. Now, when we leave this world, of course, as we mentioned in our eschatology course, we live in another body, the spiritual body. But that spiritual body, again, is the servant of the soul in Barzakh. It eats and drinks and do many things. However, something appropriate for the world of Barzakh. There are still senses. You know, the soul cannot grasp anything by itself. It needs body. And therefore, even when we leave this world, we have another body which has ears, eyes, feelings, taste, and all these things, which is, of course, appropriate for the world of Barzakh, for the immaterial world, so to speak, for the world of images. And in Akhirah, again, the soul, when it comes back to life, it needs body. So it is very difficult to say what soul is. It independently has nothing of itself, no power. Wallahu akhrajakum min butun ummahatikum la ta'lamuna shay'a. Allah brought you out of the wombs of your mothers. You did not know anything. Now, how did you learn? How did you come to know? وَجَعَلَ لَكُمُ السَّمْعَ وَالْأَبْصَارَ وَالْأَفْئِدَةَ. And he put for you eyes and ears and hearts, لَعَلَّكُمْ تَشْكُرُونَ, so that you can understand and then you give thanks to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And therefore, it's always through these limbs, through these organs of the soul, that soul can flourish. And that's why in paradise or in hell, we need bodies to live. The soul needs body. All the time the soul needs body. It's different from angels who are souls. Well, according to some without bodies, according to some they have bodies as well. However, bodies made of different material, made of light. A jinn, the bodies of jinn are made of fire. When we say fire, it started from fire, of course. I ask you one question, because this is related. If the jinn or shayateen are from fire, when they are sent to hell, are they going to be hurt by fire? Huh? Yes? How?
Well, isn't it the same way that we're made of earth and someone throws a rock at us?
Yeah, exactly. We are made of the earth, but we are not earth anymore. And they are made of fire, they are not fire anymore. Of course, they have evolved to a different thing. And therefore, always souls need body. Maybe the angels, according to Shia theologians, the angels also need body. It's made of light. The being which does not need body probably is ruh. يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الْرُوحِ تَنَزَّلُ الْمَلَائِكَةُ وَالْرُوحِ, which is very different, of course, something in between angels and God. No, you're talking about human ruh. No, human ruh is different, I'll talk about that. That ruh which I'm talking about is not human ruh, it's something else, it's a different creature, okay? Now, anyhow, let's come back to this. So the nafs has physical assistance, has a spiritual assistance, and it is very important for us to know this subtle immaterial being inside us. Man arafa nafsahu faqad arafa rabbah. Whoever knows his own self knows his Lord. A'rafukum bi nafsihi a'rafukum bi rabbihi. The person who knows his self the best is he who best knows his Lord. These are, of course, things that all of us know. Now, this immaterial essence may be called ruh as well. Now, your question. We call it ruh because it gives life. If the soul is there, it's life. Okay? If the soul is not there, if it leaves the body, there is no life. And some exegetes say, وَنَفَخْتُ فِيهِمَ الرُّوحِ, I blew from my spirit, my ruh, into it. It means the spirit of life. Allah blew life into us. Of course, ruh has many, many different levels. The lowest level of ruh is life. And then we have ruhul shahwa, ruhul quwwa, ruhul iman, ruhul qudus. These are all different levels of this ruh. We'll talk about that later. I think he discusses this here. Anyhow. Now, this is sometimes called ruh because the body's life depends on it. It may also be called the heart, qalb. So when the Quran talks about qalb, fi qulubihim marazun means what? Fi nufusihim marazun. In their souls there is a disease. It doesn't talk about this cardiac organ. Although that cardiac organ may have some sort of connection with soul or some aspect of soul, which that's why it's called qalb. However, he says the ruh or the nafs is called qalb because of its changing attitude. It always changes, and qalb means something which changes all the time. يُغَلِّبُ اللَّهُ اللَّيْلَ وَالنَّهَارِ, Allah changes night and the day. This is qalb, isn't it? And because the soul, you see, in the morning you have one mood, in the afternoon you have another mood. Sometimes you are happy, sometimes you are sad. Sometimes you are positive, sometimes you are negative. And this changing attitude, that's magnificent for human soul, and that's why it's called qalb, because it's always in changing. Okay? So, called heart because of its changing taqallub, changing thoughts. It may also be called the intellect, aql. So when we say aql or intellect, we mean the soul, human soul. Now these four, nafs, ruh, qalb, and aql, are called together al-qara'in. Al-qara'in means they are always together. They are always hand in hand with each other. They are actually entities which are different words used for the same entity, the spiritual entity. Now, on page 84, he says there are also other descriptions for the self. When it is at peace with its divine command, with the divine commands and prohibition, it no longer feels agitated because it has resisted its carnal desire. It's called the serene soul, an-nafsul mutma'inna. Means you do not fight with yourself anymore. You are at peace with all divine instructions. And because divine instructions bring peace to the heart, your heart is at this level of an-nafsul mutma'inna. It's the same nafs. We don't have three sources of nafs, for example, an-nafsul mutma'inna, an-nafsul lawwama, an-nafsul ammara. It's the same nafs which acquires different levels. Now, we know that most of us are not in that position because we commit sin sometimes. Committing sin means that we are struggling. We are somehow trying to do what? To become at peace with divine law. And therefore, we don't have that tranquil heart yet, which is always in remembrance of God. Because we usually neglect and forget God. That is why the heart sinks and it loses its tranquility. Because the Quran says very clearly, Allah bidhikrillah tatma'innul qulub. It's only with the remembrance of God that hearts find tranquility. And because we usually very scarcely remember God in our life. When I say scarcely, I mean that very serious remembrance of Allah which brings the feeling of His presence into our heart. Therefore, our heart is always battling, struggling with the divine law. And when we do a mistake, it comes back at us. It slashes us with criticism. Why did you do that? Repent to Allah. Ask forgiveness from Allah. This is called an-nafsul lawwama, the reproaching soul. Now, it's the same soul, but it is at the level of reproaching and agitation. It's not at peace with itself. So, if it has not yet achieved this tranquility, but fights its base desires and anger, and this is what we are always doing, we are struggling with our anger, we are struggling with our desires. It is called the self-reproaching soul, an-nafsul lawwama, since it reproaches its owner when he falls short in worshipping his master. And this level for the soul, which is in Ashabul Yameen, is so important that Allah swears by it. La uqsimu bin-nafsil lawwama. I swear by this reproaching soul, which is, of course, a station reached by mu'minu. Now, if, on the other hand, the soul is at peace with itself from the other side, absolutely has left God, and is indulging in the world, of course, it's a parody. I'm not saying that it says peace, because the heart cannot find peace in the world. So, if indulges completely, and the soul commands all the time the desire and the anger to work on his behalf, on its behalf, then it's an-nafsul ammarate bisu, the nafs which commands evil. So, if it stops resisting, now, as long as the soul is resisting, it's good, it's nafsul lawwama. But if the soul stops resisting and instead yields to and obeys its base desires, it is called the soul that incites evil. And of course, in Surah Yusuf, we have وَمَا أُبَرُّ نَفْسِ إِنَّ النَّفْسَ لَأَمَّارَةٌ بِالسُّوءِ إِلَّا مَا رَحِمَ رَبِّي. If your soul stops, inciting evil, that means you are included in the special mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which is the station of the prophets. Their soul does not incite them anymore to do evil. Okay, any question?
So, Amara doesn't mean that the ishqa is stopping you from listening to
evil. No, no. The soul always incites to evil, except if Allah includes you in His mercy. Then the soul stops doing it. And that's isma. That's isma. That's
that isma. Requires you to struggle.
No, struggle is when the soul...
No, I'm talking about generally the path to knowing marifah of Allah.
Yeah.
If you reach that stage where you have reached the marifah, that Allah protects you by His mercy.
This is the isma, yeah. This is rahmah. And eventually Allah will, what? Will enter all of us into that station of rahmah. سَيُدْخِلُهُمُ اللَّهُ فِي رَحْمَةِ السُّونَ. Allah will make them enter His mercy, all of us, in the hereafter, inshallah. Any other question? Yes? Nafs, you mean in Arabic, what's... Ruh, as I said, ruh is used differently. One is نَفَخْتُ فِيهِمْ الرُّوحِ, that's a high sort of being, creature of Allah. Also, تَنَزَّلُ الْمَلَائِكَةُ وَالرُّوحِ is another being. However, in terminology, not in the Quran, in terminology, usually nafs and ruh are used exchangeably. And that's why he says, for nafs, ruh, and aql, and what else? Qalb are used. They are used to refer to nafs. Yes.
Can I say it's God includes you in His mercy? Could you just please elaborate? You mean there's a pure in heart, there'll be no anger, no jealousy. Is that what you're trying to say?
No, there's always, we discuss later on, anger and desire cannot be uprooted from the heart. And it's not desirable. They are there for a reason, okay? Anger is very good because it's based on anger that you defend the... those who are wrong, for example. It's based on anger that you try to fight against your own base desires. Anger tells you to do that, actually. It's based on desire that you want to reach high stations of purity. It's all desire. So it's not the case that they will lose this anger and desire. They put them under control. That is the rahmah of Allah subhanahu. Okay, inshallah, till next week.